This episode of the Westwards podcast is a production of Westwards, Western Sydney's literature development organisation. We'd like to acknowledge that this podcast is created on Darug land, and we pay our respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. You are listening to a special series of episodes hosted by members of the Westwards Academy and alumni as they sit down and interview their guests from across Australia's writing and artistic scene. Enjoy.
Trish Bolton, thank you for talking to us today. Your writing style in your debut novel, Wherever You're Ready, has been compared to a meeting between the writers Sally Hepworth and Jennifer Downs, which is quite a claim. To me, this indicates and reflects the fact that your novel is heartfelt, it is well-researched, and it sneaks under the skin of perceived ideas. But at the same time, it remains accessible and a really decent read. Can you tell us how you created such a remarkable tone and voice in your debut novel?
Oh, Liz, thank you for that. And those comparisons really did surprise me. The voice and the tone of the novel, it's something that happens over quite a period of time. So many, many drafts, and in my case, a number of years. So you do have that sort of plenty of time and plenty of opportunities to go back and hone that voice and play around with it till you get exactly what you're hoping to achieve. And I suppose I started with wanting characters that were relatable, that were flawed, characters that we care about, and certainly characters that I cared about and I hoped that the reader would care about. And while I wanted to explore really quite dark themes, themes that really relate to aging, also wanted there to be humour. I'm not quite sure that humour is really quite the right word, but light-hearted moments as well. And I wanted that for a number of reasons. I think, first of all, because in life it can be grim at times, it can be challenging, but I think even in our darkest moments there is always humour. And I know that's rather challenging to say that actually at the moment, because it is difficult to find humour in some things at the moment, but generally in life we can find humour. I do like books, reading books, where there is a sort of a pathos. And I like to laugh and cry when I'm reading. And if I can do that on reading on one page, they're my favourite books. Mm-hmm. And so I guess I was hoping to achieve that too. But also I wanted to balance the sort of some lighthearted moments against the darker themes. I wanted to give the reader a chance to take a breath, give them some reprieve. And also I wanted to give them some hope, because without hope, there's only despair. So I was trying to balance all of those sort of elements, but it wasn't an insert lighthearted moment here. It was more intuitive, and it is sort of the way I write.
Do you let the characters dictate where the novel's going to go?
I think that happened, over a number of drafts. It certainly didn't happen in the earlier drafts, but I think as I came to know them and I understood their circumstances, then and their personalities particularly, then it was just very intuitive about where I needed to balance some of those darker moments.
Mm. Can you talk us about how you took them into a process of grief? And this has been described as a moving and perceptive way that you've done this, by focusing on the lives of the three women who are dealing with sudden loss. Can you tell us how you developed also a multiple perspective work, so as we track the experiences of Lizzie, Alice and Margot?
When I first started, it was just one point of view, and it was just so flat on the page. And I did a couple of drafts like that, and I was just looking at it, and I just really didn't know what to do. Didn't matter what I did, I couldn't inject life into the characters. And then I sort of thought, well, this is about, at that stage it was three older women, now there's only two older women and one younger woman. And I thought, well, three of these characters have led very long and interesting lives, and I want to hear their stories from their perspective, and I wanted to get into their hearts and their minds. A single point of view didn't allow me to do that, so I decided I'd give the model perspectives ago, and I hadn't ever written multiple perspectives before. Immediately I started writing from each person's point of view. It really lifted off the page. That was sort of quite amazing for me. And I didn't find it difficult, actually. I sort of found myself getting to know the characters really well through that process.
You interrogate the ordinary lives of older Australian women. Would you say that you're actually disrupting ageism in this love letter to older women?
Well, I did want to write against the stereotype being either very frail old ladies, women in nursing homes, pushing frames, or the alternative stereotype is this sort of zany older woman with maybe the crazy hair and the crazy clothes. They just weren't the sort of women that I know. And I'm not quite the age of my protagonist, but I'm a lot closer now than I was when I first started writing. And they don't represent my life, and they don't represent the women that I know. I wanted to write women that I could relate to. And so writing against the stereotype, I thought about all the women when I go to festivals, all the older women that I see at festivals, at book festivals, at the theatre, at the cinema, older women who are politically engaged, older women who support their families and their communities. I think older women are the beating social and cultural heart of our community. They're also women who are desiring and desirable. They're not just these benign presences in a room. They're living life to their full, and I wanted to show those women in my story.
I love what you say there about that sort of characterisation of the zany older person, or the person who's disenfranchised in every sense and been thrown into a, you know, some sort of care situation and had everything removed that was about their life. I spoke to Rachel Matthews last week, and I noticed that she's talking about the idea of deleting the concept of middle age. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I just couldn't agree more, actually. Because when you hear middle age, what's the first, you know, the image that you summon? It's always it's a stereotype, and it's not a flattering stereotype. And what is middle age anyway? Is it 40s, 50s, 60s? How do we sort of classify that? And I really think that we have this sort of little file that we have old people, and we just put them in there. And old can be, depending on individuals, can be people who are 40 or people who are 90. And you'd never compare a 40-year-old to a 20-year-old, or think of a 60-year-old comparing a 60-year-old to a 40-year-old. But here we are, old as sort of somewhere between 50 and 60 and 90 and 100. And we just sort of lump them all into this sort of one group, this amorphous group. And so I think labels don't serve us well.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think often about this question of what is middle age. And when I think about that, I can't actually work out how that applies to my own life or what it means. So I found it really interesting that you're both sort of approaching that idea. And it also, you know, the experience and contribution that life experience brings to us as women as we go through life. And you also write about grief. It used to be said that the only way through grief is through grief. Is that still the same? Can you talk us through what you know about grief and how grief works?
I think attitudes to grief are changing. I think we understand it a little bit more. I think we're more sort of tolerant of it. That's probably a strange word to use about tolerant, but you do hear people say it's been 12 months now and, you know, perhaps they should be sort of moving on a little. So I think what I wanted to explore some of that in my story, but I don't think we're ever through grief. I think we learn to live with it. I think we learn to accept it. What else can we do? And grief can so unexpectedly, suddenly overwhelmed by a feeling of grief, just thinking about someone who perhaps passed away 30 years before, and just suddenly you're overwhelmed by that sort of sense of loss and you don't really know what prompted it. And other times you do know what prompted it. It could be, you know, a song, or it could be a season. Something that you associate with a person that you've loved and that you've lost. So are we ever through grief? I don't really think that we ever are, certainly not in my own experience. You know, I can still grieve pets that I had as a child. And I can certainly grieve, you know, my parents who I lost, you know, quite a number of years ago. And of course you can grieve more than death as well.
All sorts of things. And I love how you're talking about music, that sense of music taking you back to a moment in time. And I also find the taste of food or smells, fragrances, perfumes.
Yes, smells.
That can really take you back to a moment in time as though it's still happening right now. Does that happen for you?
It does, yes. Definitely smells, definitely fragrances from the garden. Plants, flowers. I know there's a plant that's just been in flower in Melbourne recently called star jasmine. Always think of my son when I smell that fragrance, because it flowers in November and my son was born in November. Yeah, so I do associate garden smells, garden fragrances a lot with people, with moments.
That's really interesting. How did you workshop these elements? You had the mentorship with Nadine Davidoff, and your manuscript was selected by the Australian Society of Authors for the mentorship program. Given the highly competitive nature of the market, what was this experience like for you?
Oh, look, that was really a life-changing moment for my writing, I think. Yeah, winning the mentorship and then being paired with Nadine, Nadine Davidoff, who is one of the best editors in Australia. That was, really amazing. I'd always wanted to work with an editor. I thought, I'm never going to be a writer until I can work with an editor. And I think in many ways that's true for me. I can't say that for others, of course. So I met with Nadine. I think it was just pre-COVID, actually. And we met in a cafe and had coffee, and she chatted about the manuscript. I really wished I'd recorded that session, because she just had so much to say and so many insights. It was quite incredible. And I was sitting there thinking, she knows more about my characters than I do. And
she's very perceptive.
She is very perceptive. She certainly knew about the emotional landscape very, very, very well. She advised me to kill off a couple of characters. They weren't doing anything. They really served no purpose. I'd really just kept them in because, you know, I quite liked that line or like that bit of dialogue. But what else were they doing? They were doing nothing, really. So I quite happily killed those off. She pointed out gaps in the narrative. She pointed out bagginess. It was really quite amazing too, because towards the end of the manuscript, there were many chapters that weren't really completed. They were sort of halfway there, and I felt a bit uncomfortable about not presenting her with a completely formed manuscript, but she wasn't fazed a little bit by that. And then we met again. She just said, go off and redraft, write another draft, a couple more drafts, and I'll see you again in a year. So, and contact me if you need anything. Talk to you about anything, which I did do. I did make a couple of contacts with her during that time, and she was always very generous and very supportive. We met again, but then it was COVID and we met on Zoom, and she went through the manuscript pretty much page by page with me. Really wonderful for me at that time, you know, suffering lots of imposter syndrome and feeling unsure about the manuscript, was her enthusiasm for it. And how much she loved the female characters. Yeah, that just gave me a lot of confidence.
Yeah, that's really amazing. Told on a manuscript assessment one time that it'd take 10 years for a writer to develop the skills to publish a novel. Do you think that's realistic?
It took me 10 years. Look, I was in a writer's group when I first started writing. All of those writers, or three of those writers, were all picked up within the first 2 or 3 years. One person was picked up almost immediately and another a couple of years later. I mean, there was some luck involved, but they really were picked up because, you know, they were outstanding writers. They were fabulous writers, and a couple have gone on to do extremely well. And there would be names that you would know, but I won't mention them. But I think for most of us, it takes a long, long time. You know, we just have to hone our skills. I think they say it takes 10,000 hours to be really good at anything, but perhaps with writing, it's a lot more than 10,000 hours. Of course, it's not true for everyone. Lots of people, you know, get picked up, but I think it usually does take at least a few years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what about the idea? I mean, because this is not your first novel, this is your first published novel, and your previous novel also received some fairly good responses and some really great awards. Would you like to talk to us about that?
I think because it kept receiving long listings and short listings, and I got to Varuna on the back of that novel, I kept sort of persevering with it, and I sort of wished I'd given it away a little bit earlier, actually, because I just, something else, it'd win something else, and I think, okay, well, it's got something and I'm going to keep going. But it was really good for building a bit of a CV, and I think building a CV is really important for any emerging writer. So that when you do submit, you've got glance over that CV and say, yep, okay, so she's obviously got something, she can write, and so her manuscript is worth my time. So I would say in the end, it was sort of worthwhile, even though that manuscript is still sitting in a bottom drawer somewhere.
Do we go back to our old manuscripts, or do we leave them behind?
I've thought about that. It's very different to what I've written now. It's much, much more lighthearted. And it's certainly not about aging and ageism. It's a much younger protagonist. But I can still see that the things that interest me interested me in that manuscript. I'm not sure. I'll see if my publisher shows any interest. But perhaps now I think I'm moving on to something else.
That's very interesting. What do you think has surprised you the most in the pathway to publication? Can you tell us a little bit about how you secured your publishing deal with Allen & Unwin?
Yes, well, everything surprised me about the publishing process, Liz. Look, I had submitted my manuscript to quite a number of agents, and it had been rejected. And I'd submitted it to a number of publishers, and it was still with a number of publishers when I sent it to Allen & Unwin, but it had also been rejected by a number two. And I contacted Allen & Unwin after. Well, I should really sort of go back a little bit, because when I submitted it, I was going to say it was pulled out of the slush pile. It wasn't quite the slush pile, because they agreed to me submitting the whole manuscript when normally it was just a couple of chapters. And I think I have Nadine to thank for that, because she, using a couple of her, some of her feedback, positive feedback, and I think Nadine's got such a reputation that they sort of took notice. So I submitted that full manuscript, and I was impatient to hear the word no, so I could just sort of move on, I suppose. And I contact them a few weeks later, and they said to me, oh, could you give us a few more weeks? And I thought, oh, that's really strange. I've never had that response before. And I wanted to be hopeful, but I thought, no, it's just, you know, they're very busy people. A few weeks later, I got an email saying that they were interested in having a Zoom meeting with me, and they were interested in my manuscript. And I discovered then, when I had that meeting with who was to become my editor, that actually that few weeks gap had been when my manuscript was being taken to acquisitions. So wow. I'm quite glad I didn't know, because I would have been a bit beside myself while I waited. So wow. There you are. So that's how it sort of happened. So, yeah, I'm that sort of person that got dragged out of the slush pile. And and I had had, as I said, I'd had quite a number of rejections. Literally a couple of days later, I would have had another offer on that manuscript.
Oh, wow.
So from another publishing house. So, you know, just never give up hope, really.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And what you do sort of learn is the luck that I talked about before. It's landing on the right desk in front of the right person at the right time.
Yeah.
So when your manuscript is rejected, which mostly it will be a number of times, don't take it personally.
Just hold tight. Keep going.
Hold tight.
Yeah, it reminds me of, I don't know who the author was, in the States, where the chap actually died and his mother kept pitching.
Oh, yes. Oh, that was,
And then it ended up becoming a bestseller.
That after he was dead. Mm. That's right. Tragic.
What happened after the book was accepted? Because that's a different phase as well. When was it accepted? What's the lead time between when it was accepted and when it's going to hit the shelves?
Okay, yeah, it was
coming out very soon.
Very soon. It was accepted in November last year, so that's 2022. They were hoping to get the manuscript to me before Christmas, a structural report and edit, but, you know, just too busy. And so nothing really happened until March. Then in March, I received a structural report of many, many pages. I really didn't mention before that when I had that sort of first conversation with my editor, they talked to me then about what they saw for the book and how I felt about what they saw for the book, the changes. And after that, there was a copy edit. And then after that, there's proofreading. And so that goes on over a number of months. So that really went on up until just a few weeks ago. So the structural edit began in March. And I think, you know, I handed it in at the end of October, something like that, after going through the proofreading stages. Yeah,
that's quite a long time, isn't it?
It's quite a long time, but sort of it's got to go back then, and they've got to sort of work on it. Then after the copy edit, there's typesetting, and then the proofreading, which is the most satisfying part of the process, because you're polishing, and that's really sort of wonderful. And you can just see it all coming together and all the work you've done coming together.
Mm-hmm.
But it is quite a process. Yeah, I think, you know, probably 6 or 9 months. I mean, some people don't have to have a structural edit, but then they might have a very big copy edit. So there's no absolute formula. It's every publishing house is different, and every writer's manuscript is different.
Wow.
My structural edit was quite big because I had to lose a character. And so that was a big amount of work to do.
That's really interesting. I think it would do my head in trying to lose a character.
It's really incredible, because you think that you've written them out, and then you're at the copy edit stage or even the proofreading stage, and you can see a pronoun in the sentence that suggests that there is this other person still there. So, you know, you're really eliminating them right up until almost the very end.
Those characters are haunting the book even when they're taken out and told to go appear in some other book. Would you do that? Would you keep that character for a different book?
Oh, yes. Yes, I think that I will.
Mm-hmm.
I think that this character will, yes, emerge in my next novel. You know, obviously slightly in a slightly different, in obviously in a very different story, but her character, I think her character will be there in my next novel.
Have you
novel.
Started working on another novel?
Oh, just really a few chapters. Not a few chapters, a few pages.
A few pages. Well, that's all right. High concept pages, I'm sure. You're also part of a group of debut novelists who are all releasing in 2024. And I guess we have Instagram to thank for this. What can you tell us about the debut crew, the hashtag debut crew, who's involved, and how you're planning to support each other through the release of your new books in a time that's very challenging for writers and publishers?
That's really been a fantastic part of this whole publishing journey, if I can use that overused word. We're all sort of sharing the same experience. We're all on the same roller coaster at different times where, we have each other's backs, really. And it's a really quite an intimate space. I mean, most of us have never met, and yet we're sharing these things with each other that you would just ordinarily never share with strangers. Yes, but we do all have each other's back. We're trying to support each other's writing. We're sort of feeling the highs and the lows with each other. You know, we get excited seeing, you know, little sneak peeks at each other's covers before we can show them anywhere else. And just generally, if you've got, you can be as vulnerable as you like. You can ask a dumb question. Someone's always got an answer. Just really, it's quite a wonderful experience. I'm really very grateful for it, and I'm very glad that I joined. There's about 45 of us, actually.
Oh, wow.
And they're from every genre too. There's every genre, sort of literary, commercial, children's, crime, illustrators, and it really does make you appreciate all the different genres.
I've
particularly come to appreciate people who write for children, because and their covers and their words are, it's really wonderful to sort of get to know them.
Hashtag
and what
debut
them.
Crew, it's something to follow. who set it up? Who pulled it all together?
Lisa Kenway. She pulled it all together, but there was a 2023 debut crew, which was very successful too. And I think Lisa was convinced by Kate Mildenhall actually to take it on. And I think it actually emerged from First Time Podcast, which Kate Mildenhall was part of. Yeah, that's where it started. And I think it will go from success to success. And Lisa is marvellous. She's that sort of person. She's, you know, got a very demanding career. She's working on her own manuscript or on her own novel, the editing process, and, you know, supporting or pulled together the debut crew and also doing lots of other things to support us. So, she's a very good example of ask a busy person.
There you go. That's very interesting. Trish, thank you so much for joining us today. I've really enjoyed talking with you and best of luck with the release of your very first novel. I can't wait to see it on the shelves. And thank you for joining us today.
Oh, Liz, thank you so much. It's been wonderful to talk to you. And thank you for your very perceptive questions. It's been fabulous. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Westwords podcast. For more information on Westwords and what we do, please visit westwords.com.au.